Okay, so you know how we keep coming across these really powerful ancient text writings that have really shaped history, right? But to truly grasp their meaning, to really get what they were trying to say, we've got to kind of step back in time, right? We've got to step into the world they came from.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's exactly what we're going to do today on this deep dive into 1 Corinthians.
Right. So today we're embarking on a journey to explore the social, religious, and historical backdrop of the city of Corinth and its early Christian community.
That's right.
And our trusted guides on this exploration are going to be the very insightful lecture notes of Dr. Gary Metters. And these notes are enriched by the very authoritative commentary of Garland.
Garland.
Yeah.
You know, I like to think of it this way. Like we're kind of like building this mental landscape in our minds, right?
Yeah.
Trying to get a real feel for the world that Paul and the Corinthians actually lived in. And our mission is to provide you with that crucial context. Because when you understand their environment, their world, the pressures they faced, the norms they navigated in the book of 1 Corinthians is just going to resonate in a whole new way. It's going to have a whole new depth.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it.
And Garland's commentary gives us that solid expert perspective that we need to really anchor our understanding.
It really does.
Okay, so with all that said, let's unpack this, starting with the city of Corinth itself.
Okay.
What was it like?
So Corinth was a major hub, a very significant city,
Okay.
and it carried a lot of weight. It carried the weight of its Roman history.
I see.
Socially, it was marked by a strong emphasis on individualism,
Okay.
where power and status really heavily influenced relationships.
So kind of like who you know and where you stand on the social ladder.
Exactly. And this unfortunately created fertile ground for all kinds of exploitation,
Oh, that's interesting.
including potential for sexual abuse linked to social standing. And even the legal system was susceptible to corruption. You could say that justice was for sale.
So it wasn't just this bustling port city. It was a social ecosystem where these issues of inequality and abuse of power were just ripe.
Exactly.
And those are some of the very issues that we're going to see Paul addressing, right?
Absolutely.
Now let's turn our attention to the spiritual atmosphere of Corinth.
Okay.
What was the religious landscape like?
As was typical in the Greco-Roman world, Corinth was deeply polytheistic.
Okay, so lots of gods.
Yes, a wide array of gods being worshipped.
Right.
And there's one particularly significant aspect of this religious scene that I'd like to highlight, and that is the imperial cult.
Okay.
This was a close alliance between Roman political authority and religious devotion, where the emperor was often seen as divine.
Interesting.
And it's interesting to note, as Dr. Metters points out, that how Roman emperors actually viewed their own divinity is a really complex and ongoing discussion among scholars.
Yeah, so like, were they just using this for power, or did they actually believe?
It's hard to say for sure,
Right.
but regardless of their personal beliefs, the emperor certainly benefited from this system.
Right. It definitely bolstered their authority.
Absolutely.
So in this crowded marketplace of deities, Garland offers a really insightful analogy.
Oh, yeah.
He describes it as a cafeteria line of religious practices.
I love that analogy.
I know, it's so good.
Yeah.
What's fascinating here is how well that image captures the pick and choose approach to religion at the time,
Right.
right? So people might offer sacrifices or prayers to multiple gods, hoping to gain favor or avoid misfortune.
Exactly.
It's like the more celestial connections you have, the better.
Yeah, hedge your bets.
Right.
We even see a hint of this in the biblical account of the Athenians erecting an altar to an unknown god just in case they'd overlooked one.
Yeah. You don't want to offend any potentially powerful being.
Exactly.
Right. And generally, Rome was fairly relaxed about all this religious activity, as long as it didn't threaten Roman rule.
Yeah, that's a critical point. Tolerance was the norm, but it was a very practical tolerance.
I see.
As long as your religious practices didn't disrupt the Pax Romana, you were generally left alone.
Yeah, don't rock the boat.
Exactly. But both Judaism and later Christianity became points of friction for Roman authority.
Oh, interesting.
And we see this with the Jewish unrest in Judea, which led to Pilate's appointment, as Dr. Metters reminds us.
Right. And when you read through parts of the New Testament, like Acts 17 or Romans 1:1-8 through 2, you really get a vivid sense of this diverse and often quite decadent religious environment that the early Christians were trying to navigate.
It really comes to life.
It does. And it
Yeah.
wasn't just a simple case of, you know, one dominant faith versus another. It was this crowded and complex spiritual landscape.
It really was. And I think to connect this to the bigger picture, the work of Bruce Winter, particularly his book, Seek the Welfare of the City, provides really valuable context here.
Okay, yeah, I've heard of that book.
Yeah, so Rome placed a strong emphasis on the city as the center of life.
Okay.
And citizens were expected to prioritize its well-being. This included religious harmony.
So everyone getting along?
Yeah, the idea that all gods ultimately led to the same destination.
Okay.
So criticizing other religions was generally frowned upon as being disruptive.
It was all about civic unity.
Exactly.
And religion was seen as a tool to promote that.
Right.
But this is where the exclusivistic nature of Judaism and Christianity created tension.
Oh, yeah. Big time.
You think about Jesus' powerful statement in John 14.6. I'm the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me.
Yeah.
That's not exactly a live and let live message in the context of the Roman Empire.
That's a great point. It really raises an important question. How does a faith that claims exclusive truth thrive in a pluralistic society that values inclusivity and the common good?
It's an interesting tension for sure.
And for the Romans, the refusal of Jews and Christians to participate in polytheistic civic festivals and acknowledge the traditional gods led to them being viewed as atheists because they didn't believe in the Roman pantheon, and even impious or haters of humankind for not contributing to the city's religious life, which was seen as essential for the city's welfare.
So basically, they were seen as bad citizens.
Yeah, pretty much.
That's a fascinating historical echo to consider as we observe these shifts in cultural attitudes towards exclusive truth claims today.
For sure.
Like, what might have been more widely accepted in some societies in the past is increasingly viewed with skepticism now.
Exactly. And it's important to keep that historical context in mind.
Yeah, for sure. And so Paul's bold declaration, Jesus alone is Lord, was a direct challenge to the imperial cult.
Yeah, huge challenge.
Which was the very bedrock of Roman authority and civic religion.
Absolutely.
That's a statement loaded with political and religious implications. And as Dr. Metters suggests, further exploration of the imperial cult is incredibly illuminating for understanding the early church's challenges.
Couldn't agree more.
Okay, so let's summarize what we've learned about the city of Corinth so far.
Okay.
It was a melting pot of cultures.
Yeah.
And a dizzying array of religious beliefs and practices.
Exactly.
Understanding this vibrant backdrop is absolutely crucial as we begin to delve into the specific issues that Paul addresses in his first letter to the Corinthians.
I think that's a really good summary.
Now, Dr. Metters mentioned some images and primary source texts that were part of his original lecture, offering a more tangible sense of ancient Corinth.
Right.
We obviously don't have those visuals here, but I think it's important to acknowledge their value.
Yeah, I agree.
Texts from figures like Strabo, a first century geographer and historian, essentially an ancient travel writer,
yeah,
provided firsthand accounts of the city's layout, its significant landmarks, and even its reputation.
It's so helpful to get those firsthand perspectives.
It really is. It helps us move beyond abstract ideas and visualize the physical reality of Corinth.
Absolutely.
Okay, so now let's move on to Corinth's specific relationship with Paul and the early church.
Okay.
This is where the timeline gets a bit intricate, isn't it?
It does. Paul established the church in Corinth during his second missionary journey around 49 to 51 AD. As recorded in the book of Acts chapter 18.
Gotcha.
But his connection with the Corinthian believers didn't end there.
Right.
It involved a complex series of letters and visits.
I see.
The reconstruction offered by Ralph Martin, a very significant New Testament scholar, which Dr. Metters references, is a really helpful framework for navigating this chronology.
Okay, so it wasn't just a simple case of Paul writing one letter and moving on.
Right.
There was this real back and forth, a dynamic and sometimes difficult relationship.
Yeah, that's for sure.
So let's try to piece together this correspondence as best we can.
Okay.
What do we know about the letters that Paul sent to Corinth?
So firstly, there was what scholars often call the actual 1 Corinthians.
Okay.
This was a letter that Paul mentions in 1 Corinthians 5.9, where he instructs them not to associate with sexually immoral people.
Gotcha.
Now, the Corinthians, however, appear to have misunderstood this instruction.
Oh, interesting.
Perhaps thinking that he meant complete separation from the pagan world around them.
Okay.
Sadly, this initial letter is lost to us, although some scholars speculate that fragments of it might even be found within 2 Corinthians 6.14, 7.1.
Oh, wow.
But we can't be sure.
So even the letter that we know as 1 Corinthians wasn't actually Paul's first attempt to communicate with this church.
Right.
That's a key piece of the puzzle.
Yeah.
So what followed then?
Well, while Paul was in Ephesus, he received reports from members of Chloe's household about significant divisions and factions within the Corinthian church.
Oh, no.
As we see in 1 Corinthians 1.11.
Okay.
Simultaneously, the Corinthians themselves sent a letter to Paul.
Oh, so they wrote back.
Yeah, seeking his guidance on various issues. A letter that Paul mentions in 1 Corinthians 7.1.
Interesting.
And it's quite possible, as Dr. Metter suggests, that this wasn't simply a friendly request for advice,
okay,
but may have contained some challenging questions or even disagreements with Paul's teachings.
So they were pushing back a little bit.
Yeah, a little bit, reflecting the tensions within the young church.
So Paul is getting information from multiple channels, both about problems and direct inquiries from the Corinthians themselves.
Exactly.
This sets the stage for the letter we know as 1 Corinthians.
Precisely. So our canonical 1 Corinthians is Paul's response to both the reports of division and the Corinthians' written questions.
I see.
Chapter 7 through 16 directly address those issues they raised.
Yeah.
So this letter we study so closely is actually Paul's second letter to them.
That's so interesting.
And we know from 2 Corinthians 12.1e that Titus was the one who delivered this important communication.
It really highlights the personal connection and the reliance on messengers in that era.
It really does.
Can you imagine the anticipation and the anxiety as these letters traveled back and forth?
I know, right?
So it wasn't just letters, though. Timothy also played a significant role, didn't he?
He did. Timothy was sent to Corinth on a specific mission around this time.
Okay.
Mentioned in 1 Corinthians 4 and 16.
Gotcha.
But the situation in Corinth took a serious turn with the arrival of what Dr. Metters calls Jewish emissaries.
Oh, no. What happened?
Often referred to as Judaizers. Yep. These individuals, likely Jewish Christians, advocated for a greater emphasis on Jewish practices and traditions within the predominantly Gentile Corinthian church.
So they wanted to bring in more of the Jewish law.
Exactly. And this challenged Paul's apostolic authority, as we see reflected in 2 Corinthians.
Right.
And it seems Timothy felt overwhelmed by the situation, and he returned to Paul in Ephesus with this troubling news.
This sounds like a major crisis point.
It was.
You can just picture the potential for conflict as different interpretations of faith and practice collided.
You can just imagine.
Yeah, Dr. Metters makes a powerful point here, asking us to consider a radical shift in how God interacts with the world and how difficult that would be to accept.
Right.
It really helps us empathize with their struggle.
It really does. So for Jewish Christians who had been raised in the traditions of the Old Testament, the idea that Gentiles could be fully included in God's covenant through faith in Christ without adhering to all the Jewish laws was a monumental and potentially unsettling shift.
Yeah, it would completely change their worldview. So the Judaizers, and their desire to maintain a strong Jewish influence, created significant obstacles for Paul's mission to the Gentiles.
Right. They felt like this was a compromise of their faith.
So with Timothy's report of this crisis, Paul himself felt the need to intervene directly.
He did.
What did he do?
So Paul made a brief, but what he himself described as a painful visit to Corinth.
Oh, wow.
Hoping to resolve the issues in person. Unfortunately, this visit didn't go as planned.
What happened?
Paul faced humiliation within the church and returned to Ephesus in great distress.
That must have been a deeply discouraging experience for him.
It must have been. But the communication didn't end there.
Okay, so what happened next?
Following this painful visit, Paul wrote another strong letter of remonstrance to the Corinthians, often referred to as the tearful or severe letter, which would have been his actual third letter to them.
Oh, wow.
This letter is now lost to us.
Oh.
Though some believe parts of its tone and content might be reflected in sections of 2 Corinthians.
So we're missing a letter?
We are.
That's too bad.
It's like a missing piece of the puzzle.
It really is. And it paints a picture of a very intense and emotional exchange between Paul and this church he had founded.
It does.
It wasn't just this detached, purely theological debate.
Right.
It was a deeply personal and challenging relationship.
Absolutely.
Thankfully, the situation in Corinth did eventually improve.
It did. After some time, Paul met Titus in Macedonia, who brought the positive news that the rebellion had been quelled.
Okay.
And that the church was back on track.
That's great.
This prompted Paul to write to Corinthians.
Okay.
Which, in the sequence of their correspondence, would have been his fourth letter to them.
His fourth?
Yeah.
Wow. So that's why Dr. Metters refers to it as our actual 4 Corinthians.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a much more autobiographical and pastoral letter, reflecting Paul's relief and joy at the reconciliation.
It really underscores the importance of understanding this entire history of correspondence to truly appreciate the nuances of both 1 and 2 Corinthians.
It really does.
They weren't written in isolation.
Absolutely not. And even after all this, Paul eventually made another positive visit to Corinth.
Okay.
As recorded in Acts 20.2. So while he might have spent more total time in other locations like Ephesus, his relationship with the Corinthian church was clearly a period of intense interaction and growth.
There really was.
Evidenced by the extensive record we have in these two letters.
It's fascinating to realize the sheer volume of communication and engagement between Paul and this one church.
It is.
It truly highlights its significance in the early Christian movement.
Absolutely.
Okay, so now let's turn our attention to the church itself.
Okay.
What was the complexion of this Corinthian congregation? What kind of people were they?
Based on Garland's commentary and the content of 1 Corinthians, the Corinthian church was a remarkably diverse group.
Okay.
It wasn't a homogenous community. There were clear class divisions, instances of intellectual pride influenced by Greek philosophy, and converts from various social strata, including some who were quite influential and wealthy, alongside those of more average means.
So a real mix of folks.
Yeah, a real mix.
And this diversity, while potentially a strength, also seems to have been a significant source of internal conflict and challenges.
Indeed. The letter of 1 Corinthians reveals a wide range of issues.
Yeah, like what?
A divisive party spirit where members align themselves with different teachers.
Okay.
Moral laxity influenced by the surrounding permissive culture.
Mm-hmm.
A reliance on worldly wisdom rather than divine wisdom.
Okay.
Instances of blatant immorality that shocked even the pagans.
Wow.
Various problems related to sexuality and marriage.
Okay.
A lack of unity and love, particularly evident in the discussion of spiritual gifts.
Right.
The presence of Jewish believers with their own perspectives and traditions.
Gotcha.
And misunderstandings about Christian freedom.
Okay.
Particularly in relation to sexual ethics and the consumption of food offered to idols.
So a lot of different issues.
It's important to emphasize here that Paul wasn't condemning freedom itself, but rather correcting their distorted understanding of it as a license to disregard the ethical implications of their new faith.
Yeah, freedom doesn't mean you can just do whatever you want.
Exactly.
Right, so it sounds like a church grappling with a lot of internal tensions and struggling to live out their new faith within a very different cultural context.
That's a good way to put it.
Okay, so now let's nail down the specifics of the letters themselves.
Okay.
When and where were 1 and 2 Corinthians likely written?
1 Corinthians was written by Paul while he was in Ephesus.
Okay.
Most likely around 54 to 55 AD.
Gotcha.
And its authenticity is almost universally accepted by scholars.
Okay.
2 Corinthians followed a few months to a year later, possibly from Philippi in Macedonia, around 55 to 56 AD.
Okay.
While its overall authenticity is generally affirmed, the exact composition of 2 Corinthians is a subject of more scholarly discussion, with some suggesting it might be a compilation of several shorter letters.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, due to those shifts in tone and subject matter.
So 1 Corinthians offers a snapshot of a church facing numerous challenges.
Right.
Written relatively early in Paul's ongoing relationship with them.
Yeah.
And 2 Corinthians reflects the evolving dynamics and Paul's more personal and emotional response to their situation.
Exactly.
In the aftermath of these significant difficulties.
Right.
Okay, so that leads us to the essential characteristics of these two epistles. What are some of the key differences in their focus and tone?
So 1 Corinthians primarily focuses on the urgent need for unity within this diverse church.
Okay.
To address a wide array of specific issues, from their partisan divisions and problems with the Lord's Supper to the misuse of spiritual gifts and the pervasive individualism that was undermining their community.
It's interesting how these same issues still pop up in churches today.
They do. It's timeless.
And here's a crucial insight from Dr. Metters. Unity is not uniformity.
Yeah, that's so important.
That's such a powerful statement and still so relevant today.
Absolutely.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah. Unity, as Paul envisions it, isn't about forcing everyone to think or act in exactly the same way. It's about appreciating and valuing the diversity within the community, the different backgrounds, experiences, and spiritual gifts, and channeling those various strengths towards a common purpose,
right?
The advancement of the gospel.
So, like, everyone working together despite their differences.
Exactly.
I love it.
Think of it like an orchestra with many different instruments.
Oh, yeah.
Each playing a unique part, but all contributing to a harmonious whole.
That's such a good analogy.
Effective leadership, as Dr. Metters points out, involves recognizing and leveraging this diversity.
Okay.
Rather than trying to impose a rigid conformity.
So, it's about recognizing that strength and richness can come from our differences when we are bound together by this shared faith and love.
Yes.
That's a leadership principle that certainly extends beyond the first century church.
It does.
It has implications for all sorts of communities today.
Absolutely.
Okay, so back to 1 Corinthians. What are some of the other key features of this letter?
Well, some of the key terms that appear frequently in 1 Corinthians reflect this focus on addressing specific problems and calling for clear understanding. Words like know, judge, discern, spirit, spiritual knowledge, wisdom, church, world, power, authority, holy, and sanctified.
It's like he's laying out a framework for how to think about these issues.
He is. Also, the frequent use of the personal pronoun you. It appears striking 146 times.
Wow.
Really underscores Paul's direct and often quite personal engagement with specific individuals and subgroups within the Corinthian church, addressing their particular behaviors and beliefs.
Yeah. It's a very direct and almost confrontational approach through this letter.
Yeah. It is.
Highlighting the urgency of the issues.
Definitely.
Now, how does 2 Corinthians contrast with this more direct and problem-focused approach?
So in sharp contrast, 2 Corinthians is much more revealing of Paul's own emotions,
okay,
his vulnerabilities, and his inner struggles as an apostle. The key terms that emerge in this letter, weakness, tribulation, comfort, boasting, though used in a specific, almost ironic and self-defensive sense to validate his authority, ministry, and glory, carry a much more emotive weight compared to the more rational and directive language of 1 Corinthians.
Yeah, you can feel his heart in this letter.
You can. It's as if the intense conflict has stripped away some of the direct instruction to reveal the pastor's heart.
Yeah, it's like we're given a glimpse behind the curtain in 2 Corinthians.
Exactly.
Seeing a more vulnerable side of Paul.
Right.
His emotions laid bare after the tumultuous events and the challenges to his apostolic authority.
Yeah, he's being very transparent.
And Dr. Metters emphasizes that 2 Corinthians, despite sometimes being overlooked in favor of the more thematically organized 1 Corinthians, is an incredibly valuable book for understanding the heart and the practical realities of Paul's pastoral ministry.
It really is.
It offers profound insights into the personal toll and the emotional realities of leadership in the early church. The kind of struggles that don't always make it into theological treatises.
That's so true.
Okay, so as we prepare for future discussions that will delve deeper into the actual text of 1 Corinthians, this foundational understanding of the social, cultural, religious context of Corinth, as well as the complex and sometimes turbulent history of Paul's relationship with this particular church, provides an absolutely essential lens through which to interpret his words.
Couldn't agree more.
We're not just reading these abstract theological arguments.
Right.
We're encountering a real person grappling with real issues of a specific community in a specific time and place.
And that's exactly the aim. By cultivating this consciousness of the world of the Corinthians and Paul, you, our listener, can move beyond simply reading the words and begin to truly feel the weight and significance of what was being communicated, understanding the challenges they faced and the solutions Paul offered within their specific historical and cultural context.
Yeah, so to bring it all together, the vibrant, multicultural, multi-religious city of Corinth, with its unique social dynamics and the complex, sometimes turbulent relationship that Paul had with his early Christian community, forms the indispensable backdrop for understanding the message and the challenges addressed in 1 Corinthians.
I think that's a perfect summary.
It wasn't written to a generic audience in a vacuum.
Right.
It was a targeted response to a very specific situation.
It was.
And this leads us to a final thought for you to consider.
Okay.
Reflecting on the diverse and often challenging nature of the Corinthian church, what parallels do you see in your own communities or organizations today? What can we learn about fostering unity amidst diversity, navigating leadership challenges, and living out our values within complex, sometimes conflicting cultural landscapes?
That's a great question for our listeners to ponder.
It is. It's a question worth pondering as you continue to explore the book of 1 Corinthians and the rich historical context that shaped it.
For sure.
And we encourage you to delve further into these topics and engage with the primary sources to gain an even deeper appreciation for this foundational text of Christian scripture and its enduring relevance.
I agree.
All right, well, that's all the time we have for today's deep dive.
Thanks for having me. It was a great conversation.
Yeah, this is great. Thanks for listening, everyone.
Until next time.